United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
It is our belief, as identified in RA 53 specifically, the notice of proposed adverse action should be the starting point of this inquiry. As the court will note, there were a number of specifications 1 through 7. Of particular significance is specification 1 and 3. Did the conduct arising from the August 20th, 2003 meeting with NALC Vice President Ron Kinnear constitute protected activity? And if such, should it have been a subject of any disciplinary action? It is the contention of the appellant that the activity involved in the August 20th, 2003 NALC Vice President meeting with Kinnear was indeed protected activity.
And what is the basis? What does protected activity mean? What is the basis in statute or in regs of the collective bargaining agreement that makes it protected?
And what we had identified in our brief at pages 11, we contend that this was 1, a grievance meeting, 2, by its very definition under page 12, article 15.1, a grievance is defined as a dispute, difference, disagreement, or complaint between the parties relating to wage, hours, and conditions of employment.
Well, let me ask you, I'm a little confused about that. I understand the MSPB decided no, this was not a grievance meeting, end of story. That was what the AJ concluded.
But that is correct. But
let me ask you, I'm a little confused why we even reached that issue. Because your client here, the appellant, was the supervisor. He was the deciding official in this grievance meeting, correct? He wasn't the employee. I'm the employee end of this grievance meeting, right?
That's correct.
And it seems to me if there's some protection that somebody is entitled to, if it's a grievance, even assuming it's a grievance meeting, that person who is entitled to protection is the grievant, the employee, not the person conducting the meeting. I mean, your client isn't even covered by the collective bargaining agreement, is he? Isn't he a supervisor or a manager?
He's a supervisor or managerial employee.
So if there's some protection, even assuming it was a grievance meeting, if there's some protection that would inure to someone based on the collective bargaining agreement, those protections are the employees, not the supervisor, as I would understand it.
And the administrative law judge, and there is no court that has cited on point whereby a supervisor or a managerial employee have subsequently been disciplined because of their conduct inside of a grievance meeting. And what we highlight on page 18 of our brief, whatever was said in the meeting, let's look at this.
So, counsel, isn't our standard review here though whether or not the decision was supported by substantial evidence?
Yes.
If we take specification number one out of the equation for a minute.
The train never would have left the station.
Why not? Why isn't there, on this record alone, without specification number one, taking aside what your client may have said to him about me, which is what you take issue with, right? His statements to me.
Yes.
The August 3rd. If you take those statements out of the equation and you keep the testimony of the other witnesses, the investigations that were done, and all of the other factors, why isn't there substantial evidence to affirm just on that?
But
without having to deal with specification number one.
And Judge Linares, I think that this becomes a completely different case because we believe that the case never would have been brought in the first place. We believe also with respect to the other specification, it is conduct 4 and 5 years prior to this incident. What the agency did, they attempted to pile on additional allegations after what happened in this meeting. And what we're saying here, there is nothing in this record that what happened in the August 20th, 2003 meeting rising to a level of flagrant conduct, abuse and beyond flagrant conduct on the part of Mr. Wills. The specifications 3, specifications 2, approximately 4 years ago. Specification 5, April 25, 2002. On August 5, specification August 5, 2002. Then a settlement agreement had been reached on May of 1998, basically restoring Mr. Wills back. But what the agency did, the Postal Service did, and I agree with you, cumulative, they brought a lot of charges that they had already dealt with.
Yeah, but in the stipulation of that settlement in 98, they indicated that that it could be cited to in any subsequent action involving the petition. Didn't set the time limit.
That's correct.
So why was it incorrect to take it under consideration in making the decision in this case?
The point that I'm driving home is I don't believe, and the appellant does not believe, that he would have ever been charged but for
his statements during the August meeting.
That's correct. The question is this, is still, if that was when the train left the station, was his conduct, should specification 1 and 3 have been sustained? Should it have been sustained? And the question I think for this tribunal, assuming arguendo that it should have been sustained, then you affirm. But clearly, if he was involved with protected activity within the August meeting, that eliminates specifications 1 and 3. And at a minimum, he ought to be entitled to a remand. And this demotion, we believe, then would have been unwarranted.
What do you say then about the finding that below that your client did not have a rational basis to believe that he was engaged in protected activity because none of the procedural underpinnings of the formal step A procedure had taken place. So therefore, he had no basis to believe he was involved in protected activity. And moreover, is there any law that says that anything that you say during that hearing, even if it was a formal A hearing, formal step A hearing, could be used against him in determining maybe punishment, for example?
Clearly, the reason they were in this meeting was because of a complaint of Mr. Woodard. Mr. Woodard had complained about what he had thought was harassing behavior. Clearly, Mr. Woodard's complaint was brought to management attention in a timely manner. Clearly, this meeting was held within minutes. Clearly, that Mr. Woodard was being represented by Mr. Cuneo, the NACL Branch 2 Vice President. The alleged harassing behavior could have been adjudicated in several ways. He could have filed a grievance for the article, and a grievance does not necessarily have to be, and I'm citing directly from the brief, pages 17 and 18, a grievance does not necessarily have to be in writing. It could be formal or informal. So this meeting had all of the requisite characteristics that are indicia of a grievance meeting.
Wait. I thought that the formal step A grievance, I agree with you that that's the informal step A, but you don't allege that's what was happening here. Your position is that this was a formal step A grievance where there was a representative present and so forth. For a formal, the way I read the, for a formal step A grievance, there had to have been a written appeal. So there is a procedure, there is a written request there, I think.
Yes, that's correct. And I think also that nowhere in the ALJ's decision did the ALJ address any legal authority whatsoever. And I hear what this court is saying today. This is for the protection of the employee. It is not for the protection of the employer, the management. And that's, but all of the legal authority, the same test for misuse and abuse, misconduct, it has to be flagrant. There was no activity in this meeting by Mr. Wills of violence. There was no profanity. They talk about the tone of the voice, and as we know, that's a subjective criteria. There was no evidence in this record that the meeting had to be aborted because of some sort of misconduct or impulsive behavior on the part of Mr. Wills. And whatever was going on in this meeting, it's give and take. Give and take. If Mr. Wills had used profanity in the meeting, if he had said something offensive, should he have been disciplined or subjected to discipline for that? We think not. We think that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And at the end of the day, that protected activity and trying to resolve the dispute and to penalize him subsequently, it seems to be a very dangerous precedent. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sugarman.
No, Your Honor, totally disagree. And the reason is, as Your Honor observed in petitioner's argument, the protections in this case of the National Labor Relations Act that apply to the Postal Service as opposed to the Federal Labor Relations Authority decision. In that case, the protections flow to the representative of the workforce of the labor organization.
Is the appellant a member of the collective bargaining unit or covered by the collective bargaining agreement?
No, Your Honor. He's a supervisor, postmaster.
Did the government ever make this argument in any of the proceedings below?
In this case?
Yes.
That
he wasn't even assuming this were a grievance meeting, a formal level A grievance meeting, it wouldn't affect the result here because the appellant is not covered by the protections of an NLRA.
In the written record, Your Honor, I don't see any argument to that effect. However, it may very well have come up in the hearing. Unfortunately, Mr. Wills hasn't provided the transcript of the hearing, and so we have no record.
Well, the government was in this proceeding, right?
That's right.
Right. And so your answer, if you don't know, we think the answer has to be no. We have to assume that it wasn't raised, right? You can't show me anywhere.
I can't point to any specific right. The issue seemed to turn on whether or not it was a grievance meeting. And the administrative judge, as a matter of factual findings, found that it wasn't.
So there's no doubt, there's no question that he was in a management position, was not covered.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. If we were to assume it was a grievance meeting, then the posture of the parties would have been Mr. Woodard as the, for the bargaining unit and the letter carriers union steward, and Mr. Wills representing management. And so it didn't have to come up in the first place. It simply wasn't a grievance meeting, and if it were, the parties were not in a posture that Mr. Wills could rely on at this point. It's just an absurd situation. No, even if Mr. Wills were acting as the management representative in a grievance meeting, no reasonable management representative could compound the grievance that was being discussed by issuing further incendiary and demeaning statements. It's just absurd. As a matter of fact, then, the administrative judge found that it doesn't apply, that protected activity notion goes out the window. And as to where the disciplinary action originated, the record contains several fact-finding reports, one that was conducted in July of 2003 that predated this meeting in August 2003 with Mr. Woodard and Mr. Wilson and Mr. Kania. And that in turn led to further fact-finding investigations, another one that was begun in December of 2003. In both of those fact-finding investigations, statements were taken from the workforce, from other employees, and those are in the record as well. And those underlie the other specifications besides the one about the August 2003 meeting. And so that constitutes substantial evidence that would support administrative judges upholding of the charge and each of the four specifications that were upheld. Really, the issue in this case is whether the Postal Service was entitled to take an employee out of a supervisory position where he engages in misconduct against subordinates. And so the finding by the administrative judge that not only was the charge correct to be sustained, and the misconduct was severe enough, and all the other Douglas factors that the administrative judge considered independently, we believe that this court should affirm MSPB's finding that the penalty of demotion was a proper one. And if the court has no further questions, we ask for affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that I ask this court, seeing some of these opinions, in particular this MSPB opinion, there is nowhere in the opinion from pages 2 through 7 that the MSPB deals with this issue of Mr. Wills' conduct in the August 20th meeting. Clearly, specification 1 and 3 asserts that whatever he did on August 20th, it was inappropriate and should be subject to discipline, including discharge. There is nowhere in the appellee's brief of any addressing of Mr. Wills' conduct in the August 20th meeting as it relates to whether that conduct was protected or not. And it's eliminated nowhere, and he brings up the issue of his activity and his conduct in the August 20th meeting at the administrative law judge hearing. There is not one legal authority issued from pages 2 through 7 that the conduct you engaged in was not legally protected. There is a lot of testimony and finding, but in fact, are you going to hold a managerial employee to some standard as to whatever you say in a meeting with a union official will subsequently become part of a disciplinary process? Now, I know this court in many terms will issue out an opinion and simply say, we affirm the decision of MSPB. But I submit to this court, when looking at the language of the decision from pages 2 through 7, there is nothing addressing the standards, whether he violated any standards, whether he did something wrong. He is in a give and take. He is in a negotiation session, so to speak, with a union representative and an employee. And his tone of voice, his conduct, how he responds in that meeting subsequently becomes a paramount issue and a discharge. There's something wrong with that picture. It's something wrong when the government nor the administrative law judge says this is the legal authority that I'm relying upon. Clearly, all of the ingredients of a grievance, a complaint, meeting with a vice president of a union on behalf of a worker, it has all those ingredients. And to tie Mr. Wills in this fashion and not give him any legal authority for this is fundamentally, we believe, unfair. Thank you.
Case is submitted.